Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining us today. I recently spoke with Michael Hathaway about his great new book, Environmental Winds, Making the Global in Southwest China. This came out in 2013 with the University of California Press. This is a book that's worth reading and is really fascinating whether you come to it with a deep interest in East Asia and in China, or whether you're more broadly interested in the environment studies, ethnographies, and histories of not just the environment in different localities, but also of the very concept of environmentalism itself. Hathaway uses a case study looking at 20th and 21st century Yunnan and the emergence of an entanglement of Yunnan with transnational environmentalism in that context to do a sort of larger and broader kind of work that involves introducing a concept called environmental winds, with which he proposes that we think about and can understand not just the case study he's talking about, and perhaps not just environmental history, but also transformations more broadly. And you'll hear him talk about that in a few moments. It takes not just a kind of traditional approach to looking at NGOs coming into different localities across the globe, that treats this as a kind of, you know, the West comes into the East and transforms it. But he really takes very seriously, in a way that's really, really interesting and really, I think, fascinating, the transformative and the formative role of Chinese scientists, of local experts, and makes this into a story that's not just about the West coming into the rest. It's really about the co-creation of transformations in peoples and environments that have really wide reverberations. And that co-creation doesn't just involve humans, it also involves animals, it involves elephants and other non-human agents. So it's a really interesting story. Again, it's interesting whether or not you come to it with any kind of prior knowledge of China and of Chinese history, but it also rewards those of us who do come in with some kind of background or expertise thereof. And it's just great fun to read as well. So it was great to talk with Michael about it. I hope you enjoy the interview, and I hope you have a chance to go out and read the book. We're here today to talk with Michael Hathaway about his new book, Environmental Winds, Making the Global in Southwest China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Michael, and thanks very much for coming all the way out to UBC today and making time to talk with me about a book I really enjoyed and I'm really delighted to talk with you about. So thank you and welcome.
Great. Thanks so much. It's great to be here and talking with you again.
Great. So, Michael, could you start us off, as is traditional for interviews on this channel, by saying a little bit about yourself, and specifically, how did you come to work on the ethnography of China? And I know you talk a little bit about this in the beginning of the book, so it's actually kind of an interesting story, but why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, for China in particular, there are a couple of dynamics, one of which I mention in the book, one of which I don't. So one of the times that my curiosity about China was quite piqued was when I was an undergraduate and going, just kind of perusing the library. And I found this book. It was written by the American Friends Service Committee. And I had grown up in a Quaker community. And so I was particularly, you know, interested in this book because it said 10 top myths about China. And it was basically designed as a kind of internationalist Quaker move to try to defuse some of the Cold War ideas around China. And it was designed for U.S. policymakers. So I read this right around, you know, a few years before I ended up going. And I was really curious to think about what are the kind of public perceptions and how, like, what is this Cold War legacy about? And then really curious about what actually existing socialism might look like. But as I say in the book, we, through a chance encounter in California, I met someone who had just returned from Southwest China, who had spent a month of travels up high in the mountains between the border of Myanmar and Yunnan, and also dipping in around Vietnam, with some ethnobotanists to find, as he called them, you know, kind of older medicine men out in the hills who were not Han Chinese, but different ethnic minority groups, and trying to do a study of different endangered medicinal plants. And he put me in touch with this amazing botanist who had all kinds of connections for us in China and welcomed us very much.
Great. So the book itself explores what you call the changing environmental winds. And I'm making little scare quotes there because it's a quote and it turns out to be a really important concept in the book. And so we'll get to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. But the book explores these changing environmental winds in Yunnan during the life of the WWF, the World Wildlife Federation project that you look at and focus on in the book, and explore lots of things happening before that and after that. Okay, so we'll talk about all of these different elements of the story in a moment. But first, how did you come particularly to this topic? What brought you to working on this particular period and this particular set of issues within Yunnan?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I had a longstanding interest in indigenous issues that first really started with North America. And then through a number of events, I ended up doing a long-term research project looking at Brazil, and I was particularly curious about the relationships between indigenous groups there and then environmentalists. So that was the beginning of this kind of fear about the Amazon, and so I, for some time, studied these issues about how environmentalists both worked with and against different indigenous groups and how that kind of tension resolved itself. So it was still very much on my mind when just a year later I ended up in Southwest China, but I had no idea there that there were all these different groups that might be like indigenous people in China. I basically had very little background about China. I kind of saw them as all probably Han Chinese. And so I was fascinated to think through the Brazilian case in relationship to what might be happening there. It turned out that we ended up at a forestry university, and a lot of our best friends were deeply involved with the World Wildlife Fund and all these other organizations that were mediating kind of European or North American environmentalism with all these other rural groups, very many different languages and other cultures.
So thank you also for reminding me that it's World Wildlife Fund. Of course, you know, I see WWF, I think World Wrestling Federation. And so it's that would be a completely different book. So World Wildlife Fund and not the World Wrestling Federation.
Right, right.
But we'll talk, maybe that's a second or third book.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. So this actually started out as dissertation work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about that transition? Were there any, were there any major transformations in the project from its instantiation as a dissertation to the book that we have now? Were there any major ways that the way you were thinking about what you were arguing changed, or any kind of major transitions in that process
that you
want to share?
That's a great question. I would say if anybody would ever looked at the dissertation too, one thing that they would see is that the idea of winds is there, but it's just barely there. It was just something I kind of noted as an ethnographic dynamic that was going on. It was just something that colleagues and other, especially these Chinese urban-based experts used to understand that world. But at that time, I had no real concept of it as a metaphor and as a larger theoretical concept. So really, it was years later that there were a few different elements of it that kind of got me going for this. And one of these that I mentioned briefly in the book was a discovery of in the archives in Ann Arbor, where I did my PhD, of so many references, both in terms of woodblock art and in text, to the 1960s kind of radical feminist movement and also the kind of Black Power movement, and how much it deeply drew on the Cultural Revolution and Maoism and the Little Red Book. And so that had always kind of piqued my interest. After I finished the dissertation, I ended up interviewing a few women who had been really kind of important in that movement. And I was just curious about the history of the feminist movement. And then China kept coming up and I had no idea. And so I went to try to find what had been written about this, and almost nothing had. And so it started me to think that actually this metaphor of winds might be more helpful to understand what was happening globally, what was changing for different topics, rather than it wasn't just about a way to think about environmentalism for these colleagues in China, but it might have broader implications that I was curious about. And that's what really helped me restructure the book in a completely different way.
Right. That often happens, right? From that one phase to the other, is that we sort of change what we imagine our argumentative contribution is going to be to the larger field that we're talking to, that's sort of beyond the particular case study that we're exploring. I think that happens to most of us probably in that transition.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you already brought up, and I brought up as well at the beginning, this concept of wins. So let's actually, since we're on that topic, let's just go right there. The concept of environmental wins is really one of the foundational concepts that threads through all of the chapters of the book, and is one of the most upfront and really significant theoretical contributions that the book is making and trying to make from the very beginning. So why don't we talk a little bit about that? Can you explain why and what do you mean by wins and environmental wins in particular?
Okay, great. Yeah. So wins in China are a very common reference. And, you know, as you well know, as a historian of China, they go back really far and they're really wide and they appear in medicine and so many fields. So the concept of wins has this broad social use. But what I kept hearing about in terms of people understanding themselves as historical beings or narrating the past was that life changes through these wins. And one of the interesting things about it was that I understood wins as this natural concept that is unrelated to sociality. So it's just something that happens to people and that people deal with it. So they would often talk about massive political upheaval as a series of wins, or the Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward as a powerful wind that swept through. And I then more thought of than people are just subject to wins. But the way they talked about wins was that especially people that are more, you know, powerful than they, but also as well themselves in this larger sense of the masses or the people, that they themselves had a role in shaping how the winds transformed. Did they pick up into this great fury and power that utterly changed their lives, or did they die out? How did they transform? And so I was really intrigued by this idea that whereas we tend to think of larger social forces as something that happens from above just to us, this other more reiterative kind of idea, reciprocal idea that involves the social in the very production of these forces, that especially things that we imagine as global and really kind of separate from us. So that was one idea. It's interesting because very few of my colleagues and friends there actually use the term win to talk about things transnational. So it's a much more of a kind of locally or nationally based concept in their own idiomatic use. But I think they would be quite friendly to the idea of expanding it more broadly. And then in terms of environmental wins, I mean, they refer to a whole number of different wins in their lives, but they said, wow, in the 1990s, that's when you just had so many people, both internationally and nationally, talking about the environment, and it was a new term for them in a lot of ways. I mean, there were pre-existing concerns about flooding or soil erosion or all these things, but to talk about huanqing, talk about the environment as an umbrella term for a whole number of concerns, had never really happened. And there were so many new environmental laws that came out and that really changed things quite a lot for both the urbanites, but especially the people who lived in the countryside, because for a lot of people, this part of China and the Southwest, with borders, Tibetan Plateau and Yunnan, it goes down to the tropical rainforest. This was the key center of kind of wild China. So both Beijing and as well as a number of other international groups really saw Yunnan as the place to kind of save Chinese nature, as well as a number of Chinese themselves were really wrapped up in wildlife conservation.
Great.
celebrate themselves.
So when you say this is actually a great place from which to continue, because mm-hmm. when you say they were thinking about winds and they mm-hmm. were thinking mm-hmm. about the notion of environment, mm-hmm. the they that we mean includes, I'm guessing, mm-hmm. Many of the people who you were talking to and interviewing during mm-hmm. the, I think, six trips lasting a total of more than 3 years that mm-hmm. you mentioned that you did ethnographic work in Yunnan. This also may include people that you read about in your archival studies, right? Mm-hmm. And so you based this study on interviews, archival studies, workshops, living in rural villages that were part of international conservation projects, as you mm-hmm. put it in the book, and all kinds of other sorts of research that went into this really, really interesting story. So when you say they, who were some of the people who you actually interacted with in this, mm-hmm. In the course of this ethnography that really stand out to you as representative of the major categories of people mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. come into this story under this umbrella they, and mm-hmm. then we can sort of get into the mm-hmm. chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And that's also another interesting thing in terms of transformation from the dissertation was originally much more more traditional kind of rural-based ethnography, you know, living in the village and the rural mm-hmm. scene. And these urban connections were somewhat peripheral, but in rethinking it into the book, I realized that these urban folks played a far more substantial role in these dynamics. So when I say they, I am especially thinking about this group of people, often in terms of generational ways, so that the kinds of too, that's the way that they understand themselves and the kinds of winds that they were subject to. So our first series of contacts, so when we first went there in 1995 and spent a year there, were often a series of people who were almost near retirement, who had been kind of China's earliest conservationists, who were scientists that were teaching in the 40s. And then, as you and probably many people know, you know, during the 50s and 60s, they were often struggled against as intellectuals or people connected to the bourgeois West, et cetera, but they were just now like coming back into a kind of second, you know, spring, as they would say it, in their lives, and were being tapped to helped to moderate all this great international interest in Yunnan. So they were this group that it actually was just now regaining all these kinds of connections that they used to have in the 30s and 40s and hadn't for quite some time. So a lot of them were ardent conservationists and interested in saving primates or black-neck cranes, all these species. Then it turns out their children were often in a very difficult space. The children had been they're the older generation than the middle generation. They were often denied a lot of privileges because they were tainted as kind of, by association with their parents. Were often moving into science, but were often denied access to many aspects of education or position. And then it turned out their grandchildren, people of the youngest generation, were now just moving up, had been educated in English from the get-go. So you had these three generations with very different sensibilities that had been much more internationalist, then much more kind of domestically arranged, and then a kind of new internationalist. So I really spent a lot of time with these kind of three generations of Chinese scientists, and some of whom became actually very influential activists. So there was one individual in particular that I talk about a bit in the book, named Yu Xiaogong, who was someone who was very interested in the potentials of expanding social justice, but connecting it through environmentalism. And he, was one of the key people that was interested in this idea of indigenous rights and bringing it to China in a place that was quite antagonistic to that idea officially. So I became in touch with him from, I guess, the year 2000 and kind of followed his his career, and I describe him and a few other major kind of cultural brokers that helped, that really helped make China and Yunnan become part of this kind of global international or internationalized environmentalism.
Great. And that's great. And one of the chapters in particular, and we'll get to this in a little bit, actually takes us through examples of these three generations in a really fascinating way, including the individual that you mentioned. So to get there, these very interesting, very focused case studies are contextualized within a larger framework and a larger history that takes many of these terms that you just used in your description, environmentalism, indigenous, global, transnational, and shows readers the ways in which these terms and these contexts don't just come fully formed into the context of the emergence of a kind of globalism and environmentalism in Yunnan, but rather are produced by not just World Wildlife Fund, officers who are on the ground, but very much by Chinese experts at very different levels, at all levels, and local peoples who are working at, you know, very different kinds of careers and jobs, who are helping produce what seem like they might otherwise be these very sort of high-level historiographical concepts that would descend upon a space rather than emerging from it. So this is about the sort of local production of the transnational and the global and the environmental in a really fascinating way. So let's get there. Okay, so I'll just kind of contextualize a little bit before I start asking you questions. So the book pays, as I mentioned, particular attention to the importance of these Chinese experts and at various levels. And it does this to open up two sort of major questions that you start out with at the very beginning of the book. How are global connections made? And why do they happen so differently in different places? And so this is a book that, among many other kinds of work it's doing, is really taking apart this idea that there is a globalization that happens everywhere in all, you know, in all places in the same kind of a way. And that's this kind of overarching similarity that gets plopped down upon the various places that we locate it. And the book is taking that apart in a really interesting way. Okay, so we've already talked about the ways that environmental winds structure this narrative, and you've also talked a little bit about the kind of contextualization, what's happening pre-World Wildlife Fund from the 1950s to the 1980s in Yunnan and in China that leads us into the story. So have you talked a little bit about that, and we can maybe talk a little bit about that more as we get to the different individuals over the course of the story. But let's get right to chapter two. Okay. Chapter two looks at the establishment of the first transnational conservation efforts in Yunnan in the 1980s. Okay. So this is a context in which, as you're showing in the book, and I'm just sort of reiterating just to kind of contextualize this chapter. So transnational connections and the incorporation of Yunnan into these connections and into the global conservation circuit was accomplished, or both of these things were accomplished, via the labor, okay, the labor being a really key here, of a small, dedicated group of Chinese intellectuals and in-country staff from the World Wildlife Fund. Okay, so let's get into this. Chapter two, starting from chapter two on, each chapter not only presents a kind of context, as I've just briefly sketched, but also a major concept that you ask us to think about in terms of this context and think about this context as reflecting. The major concept that comes up in this chapter is that of transnational work. So can you talk a little bit about this? What is transnational work, and what important work is this concept doing in terms of what you're arguing here in the chapter?
Great, thanks. Well, I have been trying to think through transnationalism for a long time, and one of the elements in terms of the breadth of theorizing around how transnationalism happens seems that it almost becomes the separate force that's separated from humans, from sociality, that just kind of moves on its own and largely seems just successful, that it just kind of happens. And one of the elements that I saw in you know, living in this place in Yunnan was, and working alongside a number of our colleagues, was the kinds of daily labor that it takes to make these connections in the first place, that they're never just easily done, but that they're, and I get to see how tentative they were. So, for example, a major Dutch organization had an environmental project that they wanted to do, and there were a number of universities that were then competing to host this Dutch group and their environmental work. And so I was quickly roped in with my university in China, and there were four others, and we spent months and reworking these grant applications over and over, and just got to see just how incredibly challenging it was to just kind of anticipate, the Dutch interest and desire, and for them to coordinate vis-a-vis these others, that my colleagues there just really felt that to build these kinds of connections was an incredibly labor-intensive and kind of continual process, and something that could be disrupted at any time. That's, I guess, too, maybe part of their idea of the way that history happens through the winds, is that it's a very contingent process, but one that requires lots and lots of kind of thinking ahead and kind of building up, trying to forge connections. And then when they break or change, trying to constantly adapt to them. So this is a way of thinking about how transnational, rather than transnational forces, just occur, of how at any example of transnational connections, that it always is undergirded by a wide variety, not just people in the capital city, but a wide variety of actors that are doing their role, not necessarily even understanding the larger picture, but through their daily action, working towards something that may or may not be contributing to making that link happen, at least temporarily.
And those actors in this chapter include everyone from Prince Philip, right? Who is a fascinating part of the story. I have no idea. There's a Prince Philip who actually toured Yunnan as the World Wildlife Fund's president at one point, and sort of initiated some of these links that you mentioned, to people who are exploring the mountain and forest regions, people who are responsible for IDing plant and animal species, then for correlating those IDs with sort of global concepts of endangered species, et cetera, people who are publishing, people who are holding conferences, people who are farming. So all of these different sorts of actors are all engaged in this process of transnational work, and including younger generations of scientists and Prince Philip. I just love that. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in this chapter is something that recurs throughout many of the chapters, and you mentioned this already briefly, which is the importance of a Cold War context, or an awareness of a Cold War context. So what's happening here? Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's something that, again, we see in chapter two, but we see that coming up as an issue in bits and pieces throughout the chapters as well. And I wonder if you could speak
to that
a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, too, that I would say in terms of writing this book, I really tried to create a very inclusive audience. I tried to, unlike many of the books written within China studies that assumes a kind of expert knowledge, I tried to just imagine a readership without any background at all in Chinese history or even contemporary China. So in terms of the Cold War, it's interesting because my students now don't really often know about it, but it's something very much like in people of our own generation, it was very much present earlier on. So with the Cold War, I would just say briefly that whereas the Cold War is often thought of as this antagonism between the United States and the Soviet Union, it turns out that in many ways, China was the key third player. So through throughout, for example, throughout Africa, it was really for different emerging countries that were just coming out of colonialism. You had the Americans there, the Soviets, and the Chinese. And it's interesting because even a lot of my peers who know about the Cold War don't actually think of China necessarily so much or so prominently. But the Cold War in China was hugely influential, as you know, and was something that in this three-way position between China, the Soviet Union, and the United States, that political leaders were very much jostling these negotiations. And so in China, as I mentioned briefly, with the older generation of people that were born in the early 1900s, they, during the Cold War era, so when after Mao came into power in 1949 and especially the 1950s, there was a deep kind of fear and antagonism with, you know, the West and the U.S. in particular. And so any kinds of associations with that were deeply compromised and antagonized. And during later movements, anybody caught with those kind of books, those books would be burned, destroyed, that the people that had them could be punished. And so a number of my colleagues there had gone through that or had hidden these amazing books, sometimes even from the 1800s, biological books under boards at great risk in their own home due to their incredible love of biology and these species. But that the Cold War really kind of pushed broadly across this area and into the, you know, still into the 1980s and beyond. So even when we arrived in 1995, there were huge areas of Yunnan in which foreigners were not allowed to go. When I first went down to Shishuangbanna, there were still signs up at all the bridges saying you're not allowed to take photographs, worried that it could be military secrets. There was a, when I go to some rural villages, some people were asking what was, basically, was the Cold War still on? Was the U.S. and China in a kind of state of mutual antagonism, or had that kind of, in their parlance, had that thawed, had that kind of the spring wind come of resolution? So whereas it was really deeply experienced and felt in the older and middle generation, even, you know, other people, you still very much felt the kind of history of the present there. As much as things had changed, that was still something kind of deeply felt. And even in terms of the landscape itself, there were a number of, for example, cities that were built that were designed to escape possible nuclear attacks from the Soviet Union or the U.S. It was just kind of hard to know who might be the enemy. So it was just there at this time of real opening up in a number of ways. But the Cold War was always there. Yeah.
And actually, as we move into the next chapter, which looks at Shishuangbanna and also looks at the context after we see in the previous chapter, the WWF has established or has sort of set up early links with Yunnan and sort of a broader, what we might call a global discourse of environmentalism. Now we move in chapter 3 to look from this sort of larger context of the village itself and look at, okay, what practically on the ground is happening as people working for and with the WWF are actually starting to work in and with Yunnan, and what are the phenomena there. One of the figures that you focus on in here, Jack Bentley, one of the things you mentioned here is that his identity in terms of the Cold War becomes an issue because he was a Korean War vet, and this is something that actually starts being relevant when people are interacting with him. But we'll get to him. Okay, so chapter 3. Chapter 3 looks at the ways that a lot of the kinds of actors who are involved in the transnational work that we looked at in the previous chapter, including NGOs, government ministries, Chinese scientists, and local villagers, engaged with what you put as the opportunities and the difficulties posed by environmental projects. And you focus in on, at the beginning of this chapter, Xiaolong Village as one of the WWF's model villages. So you use this case study to open up one of the additional major concepts that these chapters introduce, and here that is the art of engagement. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about this model village? Okay, so what is a model village? Mm-hmm. How does Xiaolong function in that way? Mm-hmm. And how does this case study help us understand the concept of the art of engagement as you're presenting it in this chapter?
Okay, great. Yeah. So yeah, I came to Xiaolong as one of the kind of key places through which my original project was oriented, which was to kind of study the effects of World Wildlife Fund. And I, done a lot of reading in the social sciences to prepare myself for this time in this village. And I expected that people in this village are about 40 families. This is in the tropical rainforest down near the Mekong River. People have just kind of converted from homes made of split bamboo walls and thresh grass roofs to making their homes out of carved wood beams and sometimes tile roofs. Mm-hmm. That I had imagined that their major life orientation was that of resistance to state intrusion, was that the state basically functions as an antagonist, a form of antagonism, really, and certainly to the perceptions of China and the Chinese state, even just talking to somebody today about this, and mm-hmm. they, the typical Western idea is this this power, all-powerful, all-knowing Chinese state, and that if anything, rural villagers are trying to get as much distance as they can, but it's basically impossible is the typical expectation.
The art of resistance, James C. Scott,
very
right?
much so, like that's the resistance thing is so key. And I thought the best anthropologists, they try to document the most resistance, that mm-hmm. The various forms or things that maybe even seem like acquiescence are actually forms of resistance if you really know, who these people are and get close to them. But I was so quickly disabused of this concept there very early on, although it took me a while to kind of realize this. I mean, there were several dynamics. I mean, one, in terms of I had to meet with all these local officials to get some form of clearance to be there. I needed to get permissions from different police and political leaders as a foreigner to live there. And I was very nervous about having any forms of association, thinking that would somehow contaminate me as somehow colluded with state power. But as the people that I live with in their house quickly told me that the only way that they would at all feel comfortable with me being there is that I had to have connections to state power as well as state power's own, approval and support of me. And as well, a number of them were also unpaid, but also members of the Communist Party themselves, some of our best friends there, which didn't necessarily mean any particular orientation towards life, but they were much more worried about being kind of forgotten as a group of people and, down a muddy dirt road over some hills than they were worried about some idea of intrusion. I mean, they were so many interesting difficult things that happened to them. So they were always kind of thinking about what will happen next. And major political changes had, swept through that area, of course. But they were working so hard to get connections to new people to as they would call them, bosses to buy their tea, or connections within the police department so that when their cousin was caught doing something, they might not get as high stiff a sentence, or they had connections to provincial level police or other forms. And people were working really hard to forge those connections, and then saw myself too as someone who might give them access to that. Unfortunately, it wasn't that helpful in too many ways in terms of those larger connections, although I'm sure that my presence has been used in ways that I have no idea. But I ended up then kind of rethinking this idea of resistance to what I end up calling the art of engagement, about how that resistance is still, I think, very much part of it. It's not that mm-hmm. these people here are not resisting at all, but it's often assumed by a number of especially anthropologists, that is this kind of almost instinctual reaction to forms of power. And then it's that especially rural people crave some form of autonomy and separation from the state. And I've learned a lot from James Scott's work, but I think that what I found there, and what I think is actually quite common in many places, is that there are very, very culturally and historically situated forms of kinds of selective engagement that people are doing, and that gave me a different way to then understand what their varied life projects were about. But it ended up being quite different than what I presumed. Yeah,
and this is actually another great example of the ways that the book is really working against an assumption that the kinds of encounter we see in the history of global environmentalism in particular places is one of action reaction, mm-hmm. right? It's another example of you're showing us the ways that co-production and of these concepts and modes of being really emerges out of a context that involves lots of different kinds of actors. And as we will get to before the end of our conversation, not all human actors, mm-hmm. right? Even.
Right,
and so
right.
We've been talking about human beings, but yeah. even the non-human actors come into this story once we get to the fifth chapter.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Mm-hmm. So this chapter, we'll move on just for just so that I don't keep you for like 3 hours talking about this before we even get to the elephants. But another couple of things that this chapter does, and I'll just mention for listeners mm-hmm. who are interested in this, you're offering like a really, really interesting picture here of different ways that the villagers are engaging. So attitudes toward wild animals mm-hmm. in various ways in terms of the local economy, roasting birds and eating bamboo rats and all that kind of yummy stuff. There's also a really interesting set piece that looks at this this figure, Jack Bentley, that mm-hmm. I mentioned, who was on the WWF's Shishuang Bana team early mm-hmm. on. And you look at him and his Chinese assistant and the various successes and not that they had in terms of promoting certain kinds of agroforestry and other kinds of projects in this area. And you look at some other projects that may have been perhaps more successful and talk about the reasons why. And so there's a lot going on here mm-hmm. As part of the story that we're going to kind of slide past and blow past to get to the next chapter on making an indigenous space.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also really fascinating. So I'll set the stage mm-hmm. for listeners. So this chapter, chapter 4, looks at what you call one of the unintended consequences of transnational environmentalism in China, and that is the emergence of new ways of thinking about and understanding indigeneity. Mm-hmm. So often, I mean, this is also really instructive because for many reasons, but one of them is often we come to historical contexts like this with concepts of the indigenous already mm-hmm. formed in yeah. our heads, right? And you're right. Sort of showing the production of that concept here in a way that's really interesting. So the context here, by the 1990s, global environmental efforts, as you show, were shaped by the indigenous rights movement. Chinese public intellectuals are reworking these concepts of indigeneity and helping form new concepts of indigeneity to make it, as you show here, a force for social critique and for social transformation. And you look specifically at three Chinese experts, three Yunnanese scientists in particular, who are motive forces in this history of production. Okay, so one of the things that comes up here in this context, okay, we've talked a little bit about the fact that indigeneity is being produced, but you embed that within a larger concept here that you are asking us to think about, which is perhaps with the big concept of this chapter, uh-huh. and that is the concept of the making of an indigenous space.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit about what that means for you in the context of this chapter? Mm-hmm. And if you want, you can bring in any of the three experts, okay. Pei Shangji, Xu Jianchu, or Yu Xiaogang that you introduced so usefully for us here.
Great, thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting, too, as I mentioned earlier, about how I was very much involved and interested in the indigenous movement throughout the Americas, so North and South America, and then quickly realized when taking that into a Chinese context that had very little shared history, very little sets of assumptions or even treaty rights or other kinds of legal political dynamics. And so I was very intrigued when I first got there in the mid-90s. Will the idea of indigenous people ever gain any traction? And so when I talked to various colleagues, they either said, look, Michael, it's either there are indigenous people or there aren't. And I played with that for a while, but then I got to thinking and kind of using to drawing on these other concepts of what are the forms of work that are required to make a concept have a kind of make it inhabitable and make it into a social force with effects in the world. Mm-hmm. So that was part of my fascination that there actually were this group of people who was trying to make the argument in China that there were indigenous people. And they were making that against the claims of the central government, who basically said that, look, we are strongly supportive of indigenous rights, but indigenous people is a function of saltwater colonialism. So it's a function of when Europeans go to North America, South America, Australia, those kind of places, those are questions of indigenous rights. And China is a strong supporter of that. And what they said, and they said this in the 80s and 90s in conjunction with other major players in the region like India and Japan, and they all basically said, the question of indigenous rights has nothing to do with our countries. Our countries are totally different. It has no play. Mm-hmm. And I studied in a way how Japan and India have each kind of negotiated that. But in China, it's still been a very central kind of position of the state that the question of indigenous people and indigenous rights has no basis in China, that everyone is equally indigenous. And yet, I mean, as you mentioned, there was this connection with environmentalism and indigenous people. And there was this fear that the creating of these huge national parks, which led to all these evictions of indigenous people in other countries, was going to actually happen in China as well. And so environmentalism was actually a particular threat to indigenous groups who ironically had lived perhaps sustainably or with enriching forms of biological diversity. So one of these kind of scholar activists was Yu Xiaogang, who was really intrigued with this. He especially worked on issues around the building of these huge hydroelectric dams, which was really starting to take place quite strongly and expand in Yunnan in the 1990s. And he himself carried out some of the first social investigations of some of these dams and what happened to people afterwards. And I remember being in a room with him, and he just came back, and he had gotten some funding to go and study this one group. And he was just saying, oh, my gosh, these people, you know, basically these are indigenous people. They were now reduced to picking trash in landfills, and this is horrible. And his colleague there at the Academy of Social Science said, oh, that's amazing, but you can't tell anyone about this finding. It's way too political. And Yu Xiaogang said, well, of course, I've called up all the major reporters in Beijing, and they're making an article about this, and we're really getting this out there. And he, we had a number of conversations, and he was really interested in the idea that if certain groups of people could get indigenous rights, the discourse around indigenous rights would really position rural peoples quite differently than anything that had ever gone on before. So, in an interesting parallel between the way the Chinese state has typically created these big projects where they just, you know, people are moved willy-nilly from one place to another, or these quick, you know, bans against logging or farming or pastoralism, that there was actually a kind of parallel form of often kind of harsh laws and radical changes that were being promulgated by environmental organizations who were doing these same kinds of things. So there was a kind of unlikely alliance or similarity of both modality and practice. And he was quite intrigued by the growing, as he used the term too, environmental winds in Yunnan, but quite worried that this was going to have disastrous consequences for rural people. And so he thought that if there might be some way of using the concept of indigenous rights and then actually saying that these people actually have some kind of rights to this land and these rights should not be reduced but expanded, then this could be of great political use in changing rural China. And he worked on this for a number of years, and he translated a number of articles from, you know, English and into Chinese, and also, you know, was publishing in Chinese. And there are a number of other individuals that were part of this, but all working with different angles with different visions. He ended up feeling that there were actually very few groups that could easily, in China, rural China, that could easily get put into what some people call the savage slot or like the indigenous slot. Okay. And so that he felt that actually it was far too narrow of a term for doing this broader social justice that he wanted. And so a number of people, Tanya Lee and others, have talked about the problems of the global indigenous category in these terms, in terms of fitting into this savage slot, this pre-existing slot. But I use the term indigenous space in this chapter because I realized that it wasn't just a pre-existing notion that people can either be slotted into or not, but it also takes all these forms of work by so many different people to try to create the potentiality of indigenousness to exist in China as a real social force. So Yu Xiaogang was one of these people who just really took it up for years and then has basically gone by from that. He's ended up saying, no, it's actually too narrow. There are a number of other people who've taken that up and tried to basically change this idea that's very common in China, that rural people are ignorant, that they are damaging of the environment, that they need to be trained in modern methods and hygienic methods and you know, so forth. Tried to change that kind of modality to this new idea that they could actually, rural people who may, you know, often have never gone to high school, for example, have actually a rich set of knowledge, have actually been part of, in a way, co-producing the very landscapes that are so treasured by people rather than just being a threat to them. So it has, that's been part of the effect, I think, of the indigenous movement in environmentalism, has been a transformation of some of the very assumptions about the relationships between humans and the environment that were often assumed to be intrinsically antagonistic, to opening up different ways of understanding that. So whereas Yu Xiaogang has basically left that behind, there are a number of others who are still trying to work this category. And one of the funny things that actually happened more after the book was finished is that I found that too, rather than there just being a Chinese state that is against this category, that there are a number of Chinese governmental organizations that are actually taking it up. So there are departments of health that are working with UN and other groups on indigenous health, that there are groups of the Ministry of Forestry that are working on indigenous knowledge production, that there's actually a whole number of groups within the Chinese government that are themselves kind of fostering this indigenous space. And what you find particularly ironic too in rural China is that the category hasn't really circulated. So people, it's very rare that anyone living in the countryside would imagine themselves as indigenous. And all of the basic terms that China has to describe someone who is potentially indigenous are almost always hugely derogatory and would be never the kind of terms of appellation that they would use themselves. So I've been actually kind of thinking through this question of how can the Chinese terms or the concepts be queered in the way that, like, the kind of queer movement has, you know, transformed these terms of stigma into a term of self-designation and a form of kind of political awareness, identity, activism. So it's an ongoing thing that I try to keep up on in China. And I know that actually an article that I wrote around indigeneity has just been translated in Chinese. So I'll be interested to see when I go back pretty soon, like how people are reacting to it and thinking through this. And I'm trying to also think of China as a player. So again, not just like, as you mentioned, not just receiving these ideas, but how these questions in China may, in fact, I'm very curious and open to the idea that they may, in fact, have kind of reverberating effects that may, in fact, you know, change in currently or in the future, the dynamics of indigenous politics here. And I know, in fact, Asia has already done this, and African groups, or it's already happened, but I'm curious to understand those connections.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, yeah, that's fascinating stuff. And I'll mention too, especially for listeners who haven't had a chance yet to read the book, and I hope I hope you all do, listeners out there, because it's great, great stuff. But just to mention, the chapter that we're talking about also contextualizes you within a larger history, that the sort of generational history that he emerges from, in much the same way that you were describing at the very beginning of our conversation, right? I mean, this sort of he being able to do the work that he's doing relies on the labor of the generations who have come before him, who are, as you and you give us a couple of examples here, who are really rethinking some of these concepts that he's then, you know, sort of emerging from in really interesting ways. So slash and burn, the concept of sacred land. I mean, all this is part of this larger history. And it's really, really interesting. So I just wanted to mention that for listeners. But the elephants, we have to get to the, we are finally at the elephants. Yeah. So we've been talking about human beings. We've been mostly talking about human actors and the kind of labor and agency that humans engage in and produce. Chapter 5 asks the question, what role do animals, wild animals in particular, and elephants specifically? And I, as a sort of oral footnote, I say wild animals, but you do actually problematize in the chapter even that notion of a wild animal versus a domesticated, and elephants here kind of occupy a liminal space between those. Yeah. But what role do elephants, let's say, play in global environmental efforts? So this chapter is going to show how different kinds of people actually enlist the support of animals, of elephants in particular, to build networks and to connect China with global conservation organizations. Okay. So elephants. So let's get to the big question here that you even begin the chapter with, elephant agency. Right? So in what way in this chapter are elephants agents for you? How are you using that concept, and how does that understanding of the agency of the elephants relate to the larger argument that you're making in this part of the book, in this chapter?
Great. Thanks. Yeah. And I mean, one thing I might say too is that this kind of really involved thinking through the elephants is a pretty recent issue for me, one that I'm very, you know, actively and very, you know, excitedly engaging in. But I think actually very little of the elephant stories were present in earlier iterations of the book. And I've been kind of haunted by this question of agency. And I had a you know, discussion early on in the drafts of this chapter with a colleague who was saying that for her, agency meant action towards a conscious intent, you know, a kind of conscious goal. And usually it meant some kind of successful action towards that. And I was playing with that. And my reaction over time was that that's a fine definition of agency, but that is somewhat more constrained than what I want to work with. And also many people are quite allergic or at least nervous around the idea of anything other than humans having forms of agency. So there are a number of other works that I went to help think through the elephant question. Jane Bennett's work on different forms of materialism and other. I mean, she's a very interesting thinker around agency, and also just this idea of more dispersed agency. So someone else who I draw on in this chapter is Jeremy Prestel's book, which is lovely, about the ways in which desire and agency throughout different places in Africa was influencing the ways that social lives and material objects were produced in Europe. You mentioned earlier this idea of co-production is something I'm very interested in. And then in this chapter, I'm trying to expand it beyond the elephants, because it really got me thinking that the kind of question of what if, like, if the elephants had been wiped out from this area, and what would have emerged? And it would be quite a different way of people, of farmers experiencing life without elephants, of environmentalists trying to rally interest in this place, of government officials trying to negotiate these often really conflictual dynamics between farmers and elephants. And when I did some research in the Chinese archives about this, I was fascinated to learn that in the 1950s, the government sent down this team of biologists, and I knew one of the biologists that went down. And at that point, they, far away from this area in the tropical rainforest, they had no idea if there were any left. They thought, they presumed that they were extinct, that they had all been hunted out. But the elephants themselves, through their forms of agency, and I, in thinking about agency, think about agency in terms of drawing on Sabah Mahmood's work, Politics of Piety, I think about desire and how desire is part of these forms of motivation. And so I make no presumptions about what elephants are trying to do as a goal, but I try to look at their actions and how their desires push them forward to, you know, seek out farmers' fields of rice. And so when the rice is getting ripe, the elephants just in large groups come out of the forest and come down and just feast on the rice fields. And, you know, for actually millennia, farmers in that area have been negotiating the elephants. And it was for a long time I heard that, you know, torches and banging metal together worked for a while. And then that kind of gave way. And then when I was still there in the 1990s, and then 2000s, a number of people had gotten flintlock muskets. A number of them would fashion them out of different materials. And they would end up sometimes shooting at elephants that would be raiding their fields over and over. But then in part due to the environmental winds that kind of came through. And I was there when there was huge gun confiscation move that just devastated a number of these people who were quite fearful about what their lives would be like without guns. Then it meant that now unarmed people had to face elephants in really different ways. And there was a lot of talk that the elephants' behavior themselves was changing in relationship to that. And when I talked to friends here, it was really interesting because they said, well, wild animals are basically instinctual. They don't have any history to them. They just do what their instincts say. And in thinking through the villagers that I live with, and even, you know, and scientists and others, I began to think of elephants as, you know, and not just a particular animal, but maybe as a way to think through non-human agency writ large, who are actually quite historically situated actors in a way, in a broad way, and having quite a lot of effect and changing their behavior quite quickly.
And there are these really interesting moments in this chapter too, where elephants, I mean, that sort of line between human and non-human agency gets really blurry. So I think one of the really striking moments here is when you describe Chinese elephants as, or China's elephants, as having among the highest per capita murder rate in the world. It's like, whoa, that actually changes things a little bit when you think about it in those terms, right? Can elephants have a murder rate?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I I was trying to think through would I want to reuse that term murder or not, but it turned out that through this report that appeared briefly on the web and is no longer there, but I have a copy of it, that actually tried to document all the cases of elephant attacks. And I was really curious, does this level of engagement. I know that elephants have been far more on the receiving end of human violence historically, but if that level was possible anywhere in the world, and the best statistics were from India, and I was in conversation with a number of these elephant researchers in India and read their materials, and it turned out that in this small area that the rates of violence were incredibly large. And one of the things that was so fascinating talking to forest guards in China is that, well, I would assume that it's probably some bull elephants that are responsible for, a large percentage of these lethal encounters. Would you ever consider, eliminating one of these bull elephants? Of course, that is unthinkable, whereas in almost all these other countries, that is very much, for centuries at least, been part of the state modus operandi. And that's a form of kind of governmentality that exists. And I and a number of other people find it quite fascinating that then China has emerged as this almost like model country of what it might mean to foster forms of wildlife conservation that are non-lethal. So here we're in British Columbia, and every year hundreds of bears, for example, bother humans and are just quickly killed. But in China, this place, just on the smallest tip of the northernmost edge of the Asian elephant in Southeast Asia, that they are treated by the state with just incredible kind of benevolence or some other forms of protection. And they themselves are the major motivating force for these massive national parks that are being created, sometimes even across borders. So it's been interesting for me to see how politicians in two different countries are actually putting huge amounts of political labor into trying to make these spaces better for the survival and the proliferation of elephants, even across borders.
So, Michael, if you can believe it, we've been talking for an hour. I can't believe it because this has gone so quickly. There's so much more that we could talk about, right? I mean, in every single chapter. Is there anything in particular, though, that we haven't had a chance to talk about that you'd like to mention about the book, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it?
Not quite sure. You said something earlier, too, about the ways that, the work of these individuals are built upon the previous generations. And I think, too, I've been really influenced by some of the science studies literature about Stephen Shapin and a number of others, or the Hacking's work on the production of facts and statistics. And one of the things that I started thinking through is all the kinds of forms of invisible or hidden labor that go into, at least whether it's the concepts of the indigenous or other dynamics. And I'll give an example that we often just don't understand. And one thing that I saw when I first got there was that all these claims that Yunnan was this place of incredible biological diversity, has thousands of plants, hundreds of different animal, bird species, mammal species, et cetera. And what I found is, through especially talking with this older generation, is that they told me stories of how much, sometimes it took them years of labor of going out to the mountains and knowing what was already known to science, like incredible amounts of reading and knowledge, to actually be able to see the bird that had never been recorded there before. So all this kind of forms of social labor and all the kinds of organizations that it took to say that, okay, for example, Yunnan doesn't just have 541 species of birds, they have 542. And it really intrigued me, in a number of different arenas, all the kinds of social labor that goes into, creating these things that then just become a statistic that just seems self-evident. So I think that is something that kind of carries through and trying to understand what was going on and what is ongoing there.
Yeah. Great. So now that the book is out, congratulations on the book.
You.
What's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
Yeah, well, one thing that kind of carries off from the Yunnan project was that I was on the southern edge of the Tibetan Plateau, right in the one of the world's best places for a wild mushroom that is incredibly lucrative, and it's called the Matsutake in Japanese, and in Canada people often know it as the pine mushroom. And so I became involved with a research collective, and there aren't too many of these in anthropology. We tend to, you know, go off by ourselves, like, you know, many historians as well. And it's been an incredible time. So this research project on the Matsutake mushroom and trying to understand it as a global commodity chain, but not just in terms of how it literal value is produced from, you know, finding it in the mountains all the way to its consumption almost always in Japan, but also trying to understand what are the social worlds that this mushroom is facilitating or helping to produce in the many different places. So we have people that are working within Japan itself, within the Pacific Northwest, especially Oregon, and then I'm leading the research in China. And so we're trying to understand, you know, in these places where people really get swept up in this, I mean, and make, you know, huge amounts of money in picking this wild mushroom, what are the ways in which the existing social contour is also influencing these emerging social relations that happen so differently between China and Pacific Northwest so quickly. In Pacific Northwest, many of the pickers are Southeast Asian immigrants who are actually coming over because of the secret war in Laos and were fighting alongside with the U.S. forces, some of them even trained by the CIA in Colorado, and now coming back as political refugees. And they are quite passionate mushroom pickers, and they are often picking side by side with white Vietnam vets up high in the woods in Oregon. And so Anna Singh has been leading that part of the research. And my work in Yunnan has found that many of the pickers are ethnic Tibetans who very quickly are becoming wealthy and building these huge, what they call Matsutake mansions. And there's been this interesting Tibetan revival of architecture, of painting, of all these forms that is facilitated by this mushroom. And it's changing their relationship with the surrounding Han Chinese, who often kind of dismissed the Tibetans as being of, you know, low kind of cultural background, of being kind of fixed into poverty, et cetera, et cetera. And so looking at how these dynamics are changing quite quickly, also looking at some of the internal gender dynamics of what happens when wealth occurs quite rapidly, or and their lives become tied into these international networks with the price of mushrooms in Japan that vacillates so rapidly and extremely. So that's something that I've been involved in for some time. Really enjoyed working with my group, and I'll be leaving in a few days to to go back to China and Japan and follow these kind of global connections. So.
Great. Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much. It's been a total pleasure. Congratulations on the book, and best of luck in China and Japan and with the Matsutake mushroom research.
Great. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.